It's good to be here. This has actually been 3 years in the making with all the events of life that have taken place. And it's good to be here. And I appreciate very much the opportunity to be with you this morning or this evening. We find that one of the phrases that we have, that without faith it's impossible to be well-pleasing unto Him. That's a phrase that we all understand. And all of these lessons are designed to deal with that principle of how that affects our faith within what we do. There's two words that are commonly misunderstood within the general, or what I found within the general religious world, and that's faith and grace. And individuals, they use it loosely, but really do not have an understanding of what's involved in that. So what I want to do is I want to take a look and in reference to the matter of the book of Hebrews. I have Hebrews 11 and 12. That's where the focus is going to be. But as it is true with anything of text and context, of understanding why it is that the writer wrote what they did. And so before we get to that major part that I'd like to deal with tonight, we're going to do a quick, there's about 12 points in reference to the Hebrew writing that tells us why it is that the prophet wrote what he wrote. And so when we look at that, we find that in hindsight, in the writing of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 19, where we're going to find where the prophet sets forth encouragement to the brethren, and it will rest upon the fullness of God and the promise of what God has granted unto us that is provided through the blood of Christ. And so in chapter 10 and verse 19, he comes up to this point. Why did he start where he started in Hebrews chapter 1? Why did he start there in order to get to the point, I believe, which is what is set forth in Hebrews chapter 10? For when he said in verse 19, having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by the way which he dedicated for us, a new and living way through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. And having a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in fullness of faith, having your heart sprinkled from the evil conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope that it waver not. And so this matter of having a fullness of faith, that he deals with those principles. And then in chapter 10 in verse 36, when he said, for ye have need of patience, that having done the will of God, ye may receive the promise. For yet a very little while, he that cometh shall come and shall not tarry, but my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrink back, my soul hath no pleasure in him. But we are not of them that shrink back unto perdition, but of them that have faith unto the saving of the soul. And so we see the important aspect of the matter of having faith, having a fullness of faith within our life. And so that being, believe, the principle that he's leading up to, up for these 10 chapters, something that is said that's going to allow the prophet to set forth this principle of the importance of faith and of them, of the saving faith, and that the righteous will live by faith. The first one I'm going to deal with, and we'll deal with it more extensively than the others, because this is the principle upon which our faith resides, and that is the message and the messenger. The superiority of this message and this messenger, as we find in verse 1, that God, having of old times spoken unto the fathers in the prophets by divers portions and divers matters. So we find that when he does, these previous dispensations are set forth of how God spoke through the prophets to the people. And then we find that in verse 2, that he has at the end of these days spoken unto us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds. And so this matter of being an heir, that of one to whom, as Vine says, something has been assigned by God, and as heir is Lord, having power and authority. You recall that when the multitude heard the Lord speak, that they said that he speaks of one having authority and not as the scribes. So he had the authority. It was in him that authority came forth. And it wasn't like any others that might speak and without authority. All the authority goes back to the Lord. And so that principle is set forth that he won, that where God had spoken unto the prophets in the former dispensation, now he speaks unto us in his Son, who is heir of all things. And in that regard, we find that in verse 2, that through him God made the worlds. And there's a plurality here. The Jews have this had a principle of the worlds, of where they had the upper world, the middle world, and the lower world. And so that dealt with that of where God dwells, and the space in between of the air within the middle, and then the lower dealt with that of the earth. And so we had the worlds that he brought into existence, and it was through him that these events came about. And that the effulgence of the Father's glory, the glory of God expresses all, as Vines defines this term, that he is in his nature and his acting and their manifestations. Not what he was in the physical aspects of it, but what he was, as the disciples asked about the Father, and the Lord indicated that when they saw him, they saw the Father. It wasn't what they could see with the natural eye, but that of the spiritual, of where they could see within him, his character, his nature of the Father, that they could see him through that of the Lord. And so in reference to this point, we find that the superiority that was set forth by the Lord, as was stated, who being the effulgence of his glory and the very image of his substance, and upholding all things by the word of his power, or his powerful word of what he upheld, and that upholding all things by the word of his power, as the writer of the Colossian letter identifies, of where the Lord created all things, and he also maintains or keeps all things together. The Apostle Paul said, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist, that they exist, that they're held together by the Lord. He created it, he holds us together. And so these principles are set forth of the superiority of the messenger and also that of the message. These are principles that the prophet will be dealing with, is that of the superiority of that of the Lord. Alright, so such being the case, we find that this superiority, chapter 2, verses 5 through 18, we're going to go through these relatively quick, that here was the superiority that the Lord had to the angels. The Lord became the author of eternal salvation and brought to naught him that had the power of death, and therein gives help to the seed of Abraham. And so we find that that's what he identifies in chapter 2, verses 5 through 18. And then we find in chapter 3, verse 1 through chapter 4, verse 13, he talks about the superiority of the Lord over that of Moses, where Moses was served, and faithfully so, as a servant, but Christ is as a son over his house. Moses was that of a servant in the house. Christ is the head of the house. And so he has the superiority over that of Moses. Chapter 4, verse 14 through 5:10 deals with the perfections of Christ as a high priest, as opposed to that of the Levitical priesthood, that he had his perfection, the completeness in that. Chapter 5, verse 11 through 6:20, it was a rebuke that was coupled in here with encouragement and exhortations to promote diligence within the lives of these individuals. We know the Hebrew writer is given, or is identifying those brethren that are in danger of apostasy. And so in order to avoid that, I want to bring you up to that point with what the prophet does to show the superiority of everything that has been provided through the Lord over that of the law of Moses and over that of anything, of that superiority of the messenger and also that of the message. And so we find that in chapter 7 through chapter 8, the superiority of the Melchizedek priesthood to that of the Levitical priesthood. And he identifies those points. In 8, verse 6 through 13, the superiority of the new covenant to that of the old covenant. Chapter 9 and through 10:18, the superiority of Christ's ministry and that of his sacrifice as opposed to that of the law, of where those sacrifices were made in reference to sin year by year, that they would offer those sacrifices up. And they would have to continually do that because they were not designed to deal with the remission of sins as opposed to that of what the Lord had provided. And therefore we find, as we read in the beginning, of this principle of the exhortation to diligence and fidelity in their service to God and the dangers and consequences of apostasy and an admonition to live by faith under the saving of the soul. And so he's going to be dealing with that. He identifies all the superiority aspect. Why go back into Judaism that is less than that of Christianity? Why go back to that which is old? Why go back to that which will not produce what it is that man wants to produce? But these individuals, they were having problems within their families. They're having problems within the area of where they will forsake the assembling of the saints, as he says, which custom of some is, rather than, and this is the positive nature of that passage. For years, it was always a matter that you forsake not the assembly of the saints. And it was just an emphasis upon that. But here's the positive aspect of that passage. But to exhort one another. See, exhort. And if we're not here, we are unable to exhort, and we're unable to receive exhortation. And so there's the positive aspect of that. So we're going to look in reference to some principles that deal with the superiority of Christ. All right, we find that in chapter 11, verses 1 through 40, the importance of faith and how it is manifested. Chapter 12, 1 through 29, keep their focus on that which is above and endure their afflictions patiently. And then chapter 13, the prophet, having presented his brethren with ample evidence of the superiority of Christianity over Judaism, encourages them to have a faithful discharge of the obligations that they have as children of God. And so he's trying to bring them into a case where they will not be going into apostasy, but they will, through their faith, the fullness of their faith, that they will exercise their responsibilities in regard to it. All right, we're going to look at 5 points of consideration. One of them deals with the origin of morality. We have a problem within our society of immoral living, and morality is something that is arbitrary to a lot of the individuals that you may come into contact with. Also, that God is our moral law giver. When we think about it, it's impossible to be well-pleasing unto Him, for those who come to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of them that seek after Him. And that point of what he makes is that God is, not just that He exists, but He is. He is everything. And He is everything to us in our salvation, in our life, and how He even gives us the breath that we have. And that's what Paul dealt with in Acts chapter 17, that in Him we live and move and have our being. Our very movement is based upon the exercise of God within our life. And so we'll look at that matter in regard to God as our moral lawgiver. We're going to define faith. We'll see what faith does, what faith will do, and the result of an active faith. How is faith going to be exercised in our life where we will be able to do, as Habakkuk and others did, that the righteous will live by faith? How are we going to be able to do that and make it a part of our life? We find that the source of morality, Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20, talked about the matter of woe be unto them that call evil good and good evil, right? That put darkness for light and light for darkness, or bitterness for sweet and sweetness for bitter. And we see that our society does that very thing within, when you're talking with individuals. They'll take that which is evil and call it good. And they will take your good and call it evil. And that's something that Isaiah dealt with, and brethren have dealt with that. Godly individuals have dealt with that forever, all right, within the societies. Israel had the problem. I talked with a Hebrew gentleman here years ago in reference to that of the gospel. And he was being molded to be a rabbi by his grandfather with what he does. And that, you know, we just sat down, long story short, sat down and study from his book is what it said. We need to have an understanding of his book so we can understand our book. And so we find that in reference to that when we read, because they don't teach them out of the law. They don't teach them. They have their, what we might call a catechism, or they teach them the Talmuds, which are just kind of the Supreme Court justice, what we would call them, of their opinions, is what they use in reference to that. And we're reading through there, and he says, we weren't very nice people, were we? Okay? I mean, that was his conclusion of what he came out with, having read his book, of which he had little knowledge of his book, but he had a lot of knowledge of the Talmud, whether it be that of the Jerusalem or the Babylonian. And so we find that in reference to it, we want to know what it is that the Lord has to say about this principle of calling evil good and good evil. And so we find that's in the world within which we live. We find that's also echoed within the writing of 1 Peter in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 13. When Peter had stated that, and who is he that will harm you if ye be zealous of that which is good? And once we make that a point, once we make a point of affirming that there is a good, then we make a point that there is a standard to determine what that good is, or a moral law in regard to it, to indicate the difference between what's evil. Right? If we say there's good, we admit that there's evil. And so we find that in 3 John 11, that same point was set forth in regards to the understanding of this difference between the good and the evil. For John said in 3 John verse 11, he said, "For he that giveth him greeting," talking about this, well, verse 10, "if anyone cometh unto you and bringeth not this teaching, receive him not into your house, and give him no greeting, for he that giveth him greeting partaketh in his evil works." We understand that. And so folks will say, where did evil come from? Where did good come from? That we have a moral law giver. And in the absence of a standard, no moral law or moral code is possible to attain. There has to be a standard that if there's good, there's an ultimate good. And so there has to be a standard in regard to it, and the opinions of men are just that. They're just opinions. And it doesn't matter how many there are. Moses instructed Israel not to follow a multitude to do that which was evil. It doesn't matter how many people there are that are doing it. If the standard is simply from the point of man, then your opinion and my opinion is just as good as their opinion. And we're going to see if where that creates a problem within the life within which we live. In Titus chapter 2, verse 11, here's an interesting matter in reference to that of grace. We know with what the Lord has provided for us that the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us. You know, grace instructs. People talk about grace, and met with some gentlemen down in Mississippi one time, went into them, it's one of the coffee things. I asked my daughter-in-law, where do the old men meet? And she said, well, they meet down there at Hardee's. Well, I went to Hardee's. And over a period of time, there's three men that came in. There was one that was a Nazarene, one was a Lutheran, and the other one was a Baptist. And they studied together. And they brought up the issue of grace. And I said, what is grace? What is it? How do you define, you know, what is it? And they said, well, grace is the I said, I know the definition. I know the definition you use. How does grace manifest itself? That you can see it. That you can see grace actually coming about. And that's what the Lord said within Titus, that the grace of God has been revealed, instructing us to the intent that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly and righteously and godly in this present world. And godly is not being godlike. Godliness is recognizing God's right to rule in our life. And so this will instruct us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live righteously and godly in this present world. And the grace of God teaches us that, instructs us. And that's how it's going to be manifested. And so we find that in reference to that, recognizing the moral code, that it originates outside of the sphere of man. That's where it resides. It's not man's moral code that has been established, but and it is beyond the opinions and or the standards of man. And we're going to look to see who the entity is, put it in that regard, of who we know as God, that without faith it's impossible to be well-pleasing unto Him. For those that come to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of them that seek after Him. And so we know who that is, but when you're describing it with individuals, who is this one that is the entity? Who is the one that has this moral standard by which we can live by and have, as Paul told Timothy, that godliness, this recognizing God's right to rule in our life, is profitable for this life and for that which is to come. So who is the one that provides this for us that is a measure of right or wrong? And so we find that man was either created with an innate moral code, of which we have. We have an innate law, if you will, no matter where you go in the world, that they have laws, and in those laws you don't steal, you don't murder. You don't, as Abimelech had when he took Abraham, took Sarah, and he told God that I've been in the integrity of my heart. I didn't know that she was the man's wife. And the Lord said, I know that. And that's why I'm telling you that you don't. So even Abimelech, within their idolatry, that they understood that there are laws. And wherever you go, there are laws. Those are innate. That's what God has placed within us. But they are not in a situation of where we can't go out of them. Somebody that does not have God in their life, it's just near impossible. It is impossible for them to overcome the wiles of the devil because they don't have a basis. They don't have something to hang on to. And one thing is just as good as another. And when it's the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the vainglory of life, that's what they go after. And so we find that this moral law, that it's either innate, of which in and of itself does not tell us about God or what He would have us to do, or it is one that's learned along the way through experimentation. That's what we've learned this, because they've experimented with it. The problem with that is what we find in events like Nazi Germany. There was a Frederick Paulus, I believe it was, that he was a general over the Germans when they were fighting Russia. And Russia had defeated them. I believe it's the Battle of in reference to that he was, it was over. They knew it was over. And he received a letter from Hitler that advanced him to a field marshal. Because, see, no field marshal has ever surrendered. They would commit suicide first. And he said, I am not going to commit suicide because I'm a Christian. So even though he would have identified himself as a Christian, he believed that what he was doing was righteous. And the standard, if it's simply man, in reference to that standard, or the Salem witch hunts, or Islam, or Crusades, the Crusaders, whatever the event is, if it's a result of what man has devised, then your opinion is just as good as theirs. And so we find that in reference to it, the source of morality is that God is our moral lawgiver. Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And we're going to find out in chapter 11, in verse 3, of where faith helps us to understand that, that the creation has been brought about by what God has brought about for us. In the writing of 1 John, 1 John chapter 1, we know that in the beginning was the Word is with God, the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among men. And so we find that all things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that hath been made. And so we have this assurance that is given to us about this one that has come, who in Him was full of grace and truth, that brought this information to us. We find that in the beginning with Adam and Eve, that they had a knowledge of right and wrong. When God said, "Thou shalt not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil," they knew what was right and wrong. However, whatever you do with that particular passage, but they did have a standard of right and wrong. And therefore, we find that in reference to that, as also was stated in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, that for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And with what the Lord said, that what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, that they had a standard of the marriage relationship and the family relationship. And we can see within our society that there is an attack upon the family unit, like to destroy the family unit. And so we need to make sure that we stand up for the family. We stand up for it and do not allow individuals to try to break it down to where it destroys the family unit. There was a gentleman that had done a research on 80 different nations over a period of 4,000 years. It's what's attributed to it. Every one of them started with a conservative base. They were, they have a conservative base. They had a regard for the family, and they had a morality. They had a high standard of morals. Over a period of years, that deteriorated to where they were more liberal within their thinking. They they lessened their moral standard of what they had once had, and that they had destroyed the family unit, just like Rome did, and just like others have done, and said that within a decade of that happening, the nation fell. And that is something that we can see throughout history. You want to know what's going on today? You read history. The farther back you go, the more you're going to understand what is happening within our society today. And we find that in reference that God established a moral code regarding the husband and wife relationship. We understand that God had a pre-existing code in reference to that of murder, that when Cain killed Abel, and in regard to it, that Cain was angry because of the sacrifice that was not accepted. And the Lord said, if you will do what is good, then your countenance will be lifted up. Okay? Because his countenance, he was angry. And he took that anger out and he killed his brother. And so now for all of this time of individuals that go in the way of Cain, as Jude 11 tells us, that here is a principle that he will exist throughout the time as a murderer. God had a standard in reference to that when he created mankind. And so we find in Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 through 6, that God had an existing moral code regarding the consequences of murder. And in regard to that of Noah, that God told Noah that if a man sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. That there will be an accountability in regards to that. So God had this moral code in the beginning, that it was established when he created all things in regard to it. And therefore we find in Romans 2, 12 through 16, that of where it identifies, that having identified the Gentiles within their life and their responsibility, that in Romans 2 and verse 12, we find that Paul said, "For as many as have sinned without the law," that's the law of Moses, "shall also perish without the law, and as many as have sinned under the law shall be judged by the law. For not the hearers of the law are just, before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. For when the Gentiles that have not the law do by nature the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law unto themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts. That's that innate, that they knew that. You know, when you take an event within your life, people will talk about the gospel, that if you're not baptized, you're going to be lost. You're already lost. Okay? We're already lost. The good news is that now we have an opportunity, as Ananias, when he talked to Paul, said, "Why tarest thou, rise and be baptized and wash away thy sins?" Sin is what killed him. Sin is what separated him from God. And so the good news is, the bad news is, we're all lost because all sin, as Paul said in Romans chapter 12, for all sin. Right? And in that regard, the good news is that God has provided the means by which those sins can be remitted. They can be taken away. So he said that the Gentiles, that they did with that which was written in their heart, their conscience bearing witness therewith, and their thoughts one with another, accusing or else excusing them in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men according to my gospel by Jesus Christ. There was a day in your life of which you knew that what you were about to do violated your own conscience. It violated the innate laws of what you had, but you did it anyway. And at that point, you severed yourself from your Creator. At that point. And we've all made that choice somewhere within our life. And so we find that this moral lawgiver, that God is the moral lawgiver. Therefore, we find this principle of faith as it was defined. The phrase "live by faith" is used four times within the Scriptures. It's used in Habakkuk 2 and verse 4. And we find that it enables the godly to wait with patience. Habakkuk asked the Lord, "How long? How long are you going to wait and not do something about the perversions of the people, right? And the injustice of the people? How long are you going to wait to answer me?" Well, the Lord answers him, and he tells him what's going to happen. And we find that Habakkuk, he finally identifies the point that the righteous will live by faith. But Habakkuk had to live with that answer of just watch it. That's all he could do, was watch it. He knew what the Chaldeans were going to do. He knew they were going to come in and they were going to be like locusts. They were just going to rip the land. If you could imagine an army that comes in, and during that time, the Rechabites, if you remember them, the Rechabites, that they were nomadic. And so they were told by their father not to build houses or plant vineyards or do that. They were nomadic people. They had to go to Jerusalem because the Chaldean army was so massive, they couldn't get around it. Nowhere to go. And so they ended up in that area of Jerusalem. And so Habakkuk knew that. He knew that. And it caused him to tremble as a result of it, with that knowledge of what he had. Also, in Romans 1:17, Paul identified, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel," verse 16, "for it's the power of God unto salvation." Right? He identified that point and identified that he was not ashamed of it, for then he stated in verse 17, "For therein is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by faith." We also find that in Galatians 3 and verse 17, that the just, those that are justified, will live by faith, as opposed to that of the law. And then in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 38, which is from whence our text is taken, that here are these individuals that are suffering under this oppression that they are under. They're in danger of apostasy. And he identifies that the just will live by faith in the promise of God, thereby wait patiently for it. I have a grandson, 12 years old, and he'll say, "Wait for it." You'd be surprised how many times the Lord told Israel, "Wait for it." And they got impatient. They didn't wait for it. Sometimes we have to wait for God to do what He said He's going to do. He will do it. You think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that when they were thrown into the fiery furnace, at what point did God do something? When they were in the furnace. And sometimes just wait for it is what we have to do. And the righteous will live by faith, resting upon the promises that God has given unto us, and that we will wait patiently for it. We find, therefore, that faith, Hebrews 11:6, all it emphasizes that without faith it's impossible to be well-pleasing unto God. For we must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of those that seek after Him. And then in verse 1, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, a conviction of things not seen. So there's your definition. What's the definition of Hebrews 11:1? That faith is the assurance of things hoped for, a conviction of things not seen. It's in verse 6. Without faith, it's impossible to be well-pleasing unto Him. For those that come to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of those that seek after Him. So what does faith do? Many people have this concept that faith, you just believe. You just have to have faith, but it doesn't show any manifestation of it. What God would have us do will manifest itself. Grace will manifest itself. There was an event that took place with that of Barnabas, that when Barnabas had, the gospel had been proclaimed, and Barnabas was sent to the people that had obeyed that, and we find that in, we find that with what Barnabas had done, that in Acts chapter 11, verses 21, Acts 11, verse 21, of whence it says, "And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number that believed turned unto the Lord. And the report concerning them came to the ears of the church which was in Jerusalem, and they sent forth Barnabas as far as Antioch, who, when he was come, and had seen the grace of God." He had seen the grace of God, was glad, and he exhorted them all that with purpose of heart they would cleave unto the Lord. He could see it by their obedience, the exercise of the grace of God. Grace is favor. That's what it is. Grace is favor. And the grace of God, it was manifested that when he got there, he could see the working of the grace of God within their life. All right, so what does faith do? We find that in verse 3, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3, "By faith we understand that the worlds have been framed by the Word of God, so that what is seen hath not been made out of things which appear." We know Romans 10:17, faith comes of hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. God tells us how the creation came about, and that through faith we can understand that. We find that faith, with what it'll do in verse 4, that it offers. Here is the exercise of faith. Verse 4. "By faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he had witness bore to him that he was righteous, God bearing witness in respect of his gift, and through it he being dead yet speaketh." So we find that faith offers the best of possessions. We also find that in verse 5, that faith will provide the best in life. Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and he was not found because God translated him. God saw favor within Enoch. And so his faith was one that he offered unto the best of life. We also find that faith does what God says in verse 7 in reference to Noah, that by faith Noah, being warned of God concerning things not seen as yet, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, through which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. And so we find that it does as God directs. And when God told Noah to build the ark, to do what he was supposed to do, that he moved with a godly fear. He recognized God's right to rule in his life, and he did as God said. So faith, that it will do as God directs. We also find that faith believes what God says. Verse 8, when he identified by faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed to go out unto a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing wherewith he went. And so Abraham believes what God says, and God provided the promises for Abraham. Verses 9 through 22, God provides and provides these promises, and faith believes that. By faith, he became a sojourner in the land of promise, and as the land not his own, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which has a foundation, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received the power to conceive seed when she was past age, since she counted him faithful who had promised. And so we find that those who believe in the promises of God, that's what faith will do. That faith will cause us to be obedient to the will of God, offer the best of what we have to offer, because God is. He is everything and everywhere. And that cognitive attitude or mindset of what's going on in the world, it's all within God's control. And so we find that in reference to it, we need to make sure that we're following that same example within our life. And then in verses 23 through 31, that faith will believe in God's requirement of obedience. And that's what the Hebrew writer identified in reference to this. Verse 23, when he said, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a goodly child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandments. By faith Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, accounting the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. The same type of reproach that Christ received, that's what Moses received. And so he puts it in that term. For he looked unto the recompense of reward, and by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. And so we find that faith is going to require that we do as God tells us to do. That's what faith does. And then ultimately we find that faith in verses 32 through 40 will produce a steadfast hope. And that's what we find that the writer is attempting to do. They want to establish that faith. We want you to have hope. We do not want you to go into apostasy. And so he starts with the superiority of Christ, the message and the messenger. And he goes into the matter of the superiority of Christ over the angels, and the superiority of Christ over the Levitical priesthood. And so he identifies those superior natures. So why would you go back into apostasy or go into apostasy knowing that in verse 38 of chapter 10, by righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrink back, my soul hath no pleasure in him. But we are not of them that shrink back unto perdition, but of them that have faith unto the saving of the soul. And so that's what faith does. So what will faith do in your life? It will cause an individual to be committed to God. And if committed, then we will, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 31, bring glory. That whether we eat or drink, whatever we do, do all to the glory of God. That's what it'll do. That faith will do that within our life if we are committed to what the Lord would have us to do. God doesn't want it haphazard, if you will. This isn't a matter of selecting what we want as people try to do. They like this, they don't like this, and therefore that they choose and become, as Paul said to those of his own people, that they rejected the righteousness of God and established a righteousness of their own. And so we find that it's going to affect our attendance. Why? Because, as Hebrews 10, 24, 25 says, to provoke one another to love and good work, not forsaking our own assembly as together, as the custom of some is, but exhorting one another. We ought to exhort. We ought to enjoy. David was joyous in order to go before to the temple of God, something he looked forward to. Because you had people of like mind and like faith, and you're able to exhort them, and you're able to receive exhortation from them. And when we sing these songs, why do we sing them? We sing them because that we're to teach and admonish one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. When we sing, we're teaching. It's a teaching tool that God would have us to use. And therefore, we find we have that opportunity to do so. And so we find that faith, that it will bring that about within our lives. It will also allow us, as the Lord said, that the true worshipers of God will worship Him in spirit and in truth. And faith will do that. That will be the characteristics of our worship. You know, in Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, when there were devout men, Jews of every nation under heaven, they were devout men. That meant they gave attention to their religion. That's what that devout involved. They were concerned about it. They were making sure that what they did was correct. And these devout men, some of them had heard the gospel and responded to it. And as the Lord told the woman at the well, that the true worshipers of God will worship in spirit and truth, and that's what faith will do in your life and mine if we're committed to it. God wants individuals committed. And we find that it will express itself. Here, 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 12, David, and that's who Paul is quoting in reference to this. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 12, when he talks about this exuberance, if you will, that would come forth from him, he said, "So then death worketh in us, but life in you. But having the same spirit of faith, according to that which is written, I believe, and therefore did I speak." That's David. Paul said concerning that, "We also believe, and therefore also we speak, knowing that He raised up the Lord Jesus, knowing that He that raised up the Lord Jesus shall raise up us also with Jesus and shall present us with you." Do we have that same spirit of faith that creates in us a desire to speak about it? I've yet to find a man that is ashamed to speak or that does not want to speak about that which he likes. You get somebody that's devoted to a hobby, whatever it is, and you let them go, and they'll talk your leg off about it. That same spirit of faith that David said, "I believe, therefore I speak." Paul said, "We believe, and therefore we speak." Can that be applied to us? Because faith, if committed to it, that's what it will produce in life. It will affect our contributions of what we have, that the Lord would have us to be He loves a cheerful giver. Okay. That we are to give as we've been prospered. Had a gentleman one time, he said, "I can give a dollar to the Lord and I'd be happy. I can do that cheerfully." And he actually believed that. And that's what he did. Even though he had great wealth. Right? And so we find that here's a matter that is going to affect our heart. There's not anything you're committed to in life that will not affect your pocketbook. All of us fall into that category. And if we are committed to that faith, then God, it will allow, faith will allow that to happen in our life. And also, as the Lord came in Luke 19:10, of where He came to seek and to save that which is lost, we also find that Solomon indicated that the wise man will win souls. Are we wise? Are we putting forth the efforts to broaden the borders of the kingdom? That's where our job is to broaden the borders of the kingdom. It's not to fill up the building. Are we active with it? Now, that would be a byproduct. But our job is to deal with that of broadening the borders of the kingdom that individuals can receive the same blessings that you have. And faith that is committed to will provide that very thing. And we find that Timothy was told that he was to give attention to himself and to his teaching, that he would be able to not only save him, save those that hear him, but also to save himself. 1 Timothy 4, verse 16, "Take heed to thyself and to thy teaching. Continue in these things, for in doing this thou shalt save both thyself and them that hear thee." And that's what faith will do within our life. And so we are to be involved in it. It'll also cause an individual to consider God before doing anything. The humility of the Lord when He had the apostles to wash His feet. It's going to create a humble life. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14 of where we will help the weak in regards to that. Colossians 3:17, that we will look to the Lord, that whatever you do in word or deed, to do all in the name of the Lord. That's what it's going to do. And that's all the process of this faith that is to be active within our life. And the result of it is what you're going to find in Hebrews chapter 12, 1 through 25, that faith is a race. It's a race. And in that particular regard, that the prophet said, therefore let us also, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, all of these witnesses of chapter 11, they're watching, they've been there, they did it, we're doing it, we're compassed with those witnesses. They're not watching literally, but they have done it. Lay aside every weight and sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. That sin that does so easily beset us is unbelief. Unbelief. Sometimes people say, well, this is the one I have a problem with, or I have a problem with this one over here. But he said it's unbelief. That's what the sin that does so easily beset us. Because if we truly believe that God is, and that He's a rewarder of them that diligently seek after Him, if we truly believe that He's going to, that we're going to give an account for the deeds that are done in the body, whether they're good or whether they're evil, if we truly believe that, we wouldn't be doing a lot of the things that we do. Generally, the world that said they believe in God, if they did believe that, they wouldn't do many of the things of what they do. And that race is one that resistance is predetermined. Verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising shame, and has sat down at the right hand of God. And the Lord told His apostles that if they will persecute the Master, they will do that to the servants as well. It's going to happen. And we find that in reference to it, that this is a race that we're involved in, that we ought to be following. And it is going to, we understand that it is going to require training. For He said, verse 5, that ye have forgotten the exhortation which reasoneth with you as with sons. My son, regard not lightly the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art reproved of Him. For whom the Lord loveth, He chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom He receiveth. Going to require training. And we have that because there's promises to be had. There's promises that God has given unto us. If we will by faith, if we're committed to this process of what the Lord has provided through the giving of His Son, then we will have the benefits and the promise that was there. I'm going to ask you a question. We're going to stop here. I'm going to ask you a question tonight. I'll ask you again later on in the week. If there was no reward, would you still serve the Lord? If there was no punishment, would you still serve the Lord? That's a question that we need to ask, because He's still our Creator. But He has given us promises of reward. But what He wants is love. What He wants. Parents do that with their children. They'll motivate them. You do what's right, you get a reward. You do what's wrong, you get punished. What the parents want is love. That's what they want. And the thing about it is, we're such numbskulls that it takes us till we get our own kids, you know, that we recognize that. You know. Well, let's learn it now. Promises to be had. Faith. Is it ours? Do we have it? Are we doing what the Lord would have us to do? I appreciate your attention tonight. There's a song of encouragement that has been selected, and that we will sing that. If you have any questions or whatever, that the elders will be more than happy to assist you in that. If you'd like to stand and get the lungs out there, and we'll sing.